Good evening, everybody. James McCann here with my Science Hour. This is for November 30th, 2023, the end of the 11th month coming up here in a few hours, and then December, going down the home stretch of this crazy, crazy year. And tonight I'm going to be talking about a little bit about physics in the Bible, some things that tell us that this is what's interesting. Because when the Bible was written, they didn't know about physics. They didn't know about the astronomy. They didn't know about the heavens. They didn't know about all kinds of things that we know today from a physical standpoint of understanding how things work. And so when you read something in the Bible, like, for example, Christ's last day prophecy or the Sermon on the Mount or things like that, but the last day prophecies where he's talking about, look, they ask him, they say, what's going to happen? Where is this world going to go? And he goes, the end days, it's going to be short, but will be shortened because nobody would live it through it all. He says, not a stone will be left on a stone. Look in the heavens, the stars will seem to fall from the heavens. And he goes on and on about the moon turning to blood, which are physics effects. These are effects of large comets coming through the solar system. And of course, they're talking figuratively, and today we have to look at these and interpret them. But what's interesting is there was no way at the time that you would be able to tell a story like that and have people listen to it or believe it, based on scientific principles. So, I mean, and the people goes, oh, okay, so that's what's going to happen. You look up and it looks like so people took it literally, of course, thinking that the stars were going to rain down off the firmament, which they believed at the time, that the firmament, they didn't know about the atmosphere, that it ended, that there was outer space, that the planets revolve around the sun. They thought that the firmament was this kind of like glass dome over Earth, and the planets and the sun and the moon all moved along this, they called it the firmament. And it was like rooted in the east and in the west, and it was finite. It was a finite structure, literally a structure. And then eventually some guy went out beyond where they thought that structure should start on Earth, and lo and behold, there was nothing, there was still more Earth, just like inside the dome, the firmament. And so the same thing is happening today, where you have a telescope, let's say let's take a big Earth-based telescope that could see out into space. Okay, all of a sudden the Hubble comes along, Hubble Space Telescope, and there's no atmosphere, so a relatively small, in terms of astronomical professional telescopes, a telescope that is relatively small, all of a sudden now can beat the pants off of bigger telescopes that were already down on Earth. And so, but what happened is that they were able to see things that were never seen before. They were able to see farther. They were able to see, and of course, thinking that the redshift is a cause of is a measure of distance. The more the redshift, the farther away it is. The old story of the universe and the firmament went away because it didn't make sense anymore. But anyway, man keeps discovering more and more. And now we have comparing the Hubble Space Telescope with the James Webb Space Telescope. All of a sudden, it can see much farther than the Hubble Space Telescope. And so when the Hubble was up there, they took and trained it on certain dark areas and what were previously thought to be dark areas. And, of course, millions of galaxies all developed, and just like our neck of the woods in the universe. And so back to the James Webb Telescope, they did the same thing after the Hubble was up there. The Hubble could only see so far, resolve so many so many stars or galaxies at a certain distance. And then after that, it just didn't see anymore. It wasn't capable. The in optics, which is the study of lenses and mirrors and light in general, the properties of light, there's a physical formula which says that the size of the aperture of the telescope is what defines its resolution. And of course, you have light gathering power, the quality of the mirror or lens in the telescope, and of course, the atmosphere that's between us and whatever you're looking at. The atmosphere is a great blocker of light and distorter of light, so the distortion that occurs with the atmosphere. So although the Hubble Space Telescope isn't the biggest mirror on the planet or around the planet, it was the one that got out beyond the atmosphere. There are programs which basically take a video. This is interesting, all the different techniques that have been used to modify how telescopes work. But imagine you have a sky, okay, that's stable, clear, but you got this 100 miles of atmosphere, 60 miles, whatever it is, of atmosphere between you and it. And between the top of the atmosphere and the it, whatever it is you're looking at out in space, there's more air and molecules, etc., in that 60 miles than there is between you and the object out there. In other words, space is very, very empty. The vacuum of space is like a perfect vacuum, literally. So you can go across space to, billions of light years literally away. And there's less material than there is in our little atmosphere here. So to get outside of that is a big, big deal. So the Hubble Space Telescope was a major improvement, or any of the other telescopes that are up there, infrared or other types of telescopes. So, but anyway, as I said, the Hubble Space Telescope, was able to resolve areas that previously were never visible. Back to this distortion resolution technique, you take a big telescope, big, commercial, industrial, professional grade telescope at a facility, and it looks up through the atmosphere, and they try and get them up very high, sometimes on mountaintops, to get as high above the atmosphere as possible, but there's still some atmosphere, there's still some distortion. So what they do is they take a movie, basically, with the telescope of whatever they're looking at, and it moves back and forth, and it gets brighter, it gets dimmer based on the atmospheric conditions. But basically, over time, that distortion is to the right, to the left, up and down. And so you're able to subtract that out using a computer and get a much sharper image of the sky. In other words, you do a time average of this of the sky, and then you basically are able with a computer to subtract out the distortion. So you can make a big telescope looking through the atmosphere look like it has no atmosphere at all. It's just a technique that's used. Okay, so anyway, but be that as it may, still the Hubble had the best view of the universe. And so it looked out and it could see where previously there were just dark spots. People said, oh, there's nothing beyond there. We've seen to the edge of the universe. And then they get the Hubble up there and it looks at that dark spot and there's millions of galaxies there, things that the other telescopes could not see. And so then the Hubble Space Telescope had dark spots that it could not see. It couldn't, at the extent of its limit of its ability to gather light and see things, it couldn't see things. So there were dark spots that the Hubble Space Telescope couldn't, regions that could not see anything. And so they said, oh, we've seen to the edge of the universe. Then comes along the James Webb Telescope and looks in those dark areas and it finds millions of galaxies perfectly formed just like in our neighborhood. And what they were expecting were only young galaxies, only very premature galaxies, birthed in, like right after the Big Bang. But no, they find fully developed galaxies. So once again, the bigger telescope comes along with better resolution out in outer space, and where there used to be dark spots, all of a sudden they're seeing everything just the way it is here, which shouldn't be. So it basically, obviously, to anybody that's got a brain, which the people working in astronomy today don't, because there it's a professional, it's a religion, it's a industry, let's just put it that way. It's an industry for profit, because they get their money based on their ability to maintain the status quo. They don't want to say, oh, well, we were wrong. They have to somehow maintain this aura of correctness. And so they have to say, oh, well, it's pretty much just like we expected, and then continue. And that gets me to a point I'm going to talk to about a little bit later in the show, is just about academia in general. Had another encounter with a academician this over the last month, let's just put it that way. Not going to go into any specific details, but yeah, these people are there to protect their little realm, and anything that comes along to rock the boat, they just, and there's a lot of pecking order, let's just put it this way, in the academic industries. I don't care, pick one, don't have to name any in specific, just any of them, are very cloistered. Cloistered is the best term you can. They just don't want any outside influence. They just don't want any outside, here are people that have been working in their area for decades, and their entire life since they were in grad school, and somebody from the outside comes along and blows away everything they've done, everything they believed in, and they just can't handle it. They just it the lights go off, the deer in the headlights go on. The deer in the headlights, don't know what to do, so we just deny it, go into a state of denial. Anyway, getting back to the physics in the Bible, what I'm saying is that back in the day when these events were going on, whether it was Moses, and I'm going to be talking specifically about the Exodus, quite a few things, the pillar of fire that were raised up, and that basically was an electrical discharge between the comet Venus and ground, and they observed this. They observed this tornado extending up into the heavens, up into the atmosphere. And then the Red Sea parting was all of this activity going on. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then I was talking about the Christ's predictions of the end days, when not a stone will be left upon a stone. And we know those kind of things happened in a lot of the architecture, let's say in Peru, a good example, were built as earthquake proof. Earthquake proof. In other words, if there was a big shake, they worked together. They fell together. They were, because if you just cut stones square, so to speak, or rectangular, perfect rectangles, and put them up and built them up, if there was a big shake-up, then they would fall apart. They would move apart and fall down. But if they were built so that if they shake, they fall together, then they're earthquake-proof. They can withstand massive earthquakes and come out looking just fine. So anyway, we find that the architects of some of the great Peruvian stone walls, those massive rocks that are carved to fit exactly one against the other, that they're built so that not only are they amazing, massive pieces of rock that fit together perfectly, but they, in case of an earthquake, including an extremely big earthquake, and this is out of the realm of earthquakes, but into the realm of celestial gravitational waves, which are, like on a Richter scale at 20, where a normal earthquake on Earth would be, say, like maybe a 7, with every increasing digit, 7, 8, 9, a factor of 10 in energy, in the power distribution of the earthquake. So a 20 would be something that nobody could even imagine. You know, the amount, and that's when Christ is saying, there will not be a stone left upon a stone. He said, everything that's built by man will come tumbling down. These are the end days. And what is he referring to? He's referring to a comet coming by, a gravitational wave. And so in the day when this was happening, the general public, even the very learned people, did not have the knowledge of understanding that what comets were, what they could do, that there were larger comets. They had no idea. So knowledge was very primitive. So when somebody talks about things related to physics and comets in those days, in that time frame, it doesn't, the only way to interpret it is by what we know today. Oh, so that's what I'm talking about, physics in the Bible, is that these were the people in those days really didn't know how to interpret it. Christ also said, for example, you will move mountains. Well, in the days of Christ, how could you move a mountain with, hand labor? There weren't enough people in the world all working at the same time to move a mountain. Or how could you move a mountain? But today we know that there are ways to, literally, you can move mountains, and it's been done. Where they're, say, mining with machines, and it takes, if you've ever been to, for example, the big mines of the world, the big open pit mines, where they've literally dug out mountains worth of material over the course of decades and decades, and literally moved mountains. And with explosives, or eventually chipping away at an area for decades, where they've literally moved mountains worth of material. But in the day of Christ, they didn't know about cars or machines or diesel fuel or great big metal shovels that could move immense amounts of material, and working for decades and decades to make these big open pit mines. They didn't know about that. And so there's no, the prediction, in a sense, didn't make any sense in those days. So when I'm talking about physics in the Bibles, it's physics as we understand it today in the real world of physics, not the pretend world of academia, where they have to maintain the dirty snowball comet model. And I got a reminder in the last week or so about academicians and their need to avoid conflict, their need to maintain the status quo, and also this thing where they make fun. It's like an unwritten rule that you don't talk to people outside the cloistered union that they belong to, because somebody would make fun of them, and especially if they're older, they would like be ridiculed and lose their status that they've gained over all of these decades. And so the fear in academia that somebody would make fun of you is so strong that they cannot look at anything new. It's just, and like I say, what happens then is they go into denial and go, I don't see this, or something else, some lame excuse, and then they get to go away because they're up there in their lofty ivory tower, and you're out here, and they don't have to talk to you. They can make it go away using denial. And this actually happened with me this week. Over, let's say, the last couple weeks. Another instance where academicians, let's put it that way, are guarding their holy grail and their lofty position and not allowing anybody to see that they're communicating with someone outside the system. Everything that, for example, in one of the areas where I work in my research, it's believed that only scientists or mathematicians in their field can make discoveries because it's so complicated. But what persistently happens is that the big discoveries are made outside. This happened recently in archaeology, where for decades, literally 100 years, the old story about how man originated, anthropology, the origin of man, etc., was cast in stone. And more recently, real recently, people have been just saying, and I've been saying this for 40 years, that none of this makes any sense. The so-called origin of man in Mesopotamia, in the Leakeys finding these little people in Africa, and the missing link, and all of this baloney. You know, that man is a separate species, and that's a very poor word. That's a Darwinian term, which is a horrible term. It's a word that should be cast from the English language, but much long before women, the word women was cast from the English language. Species should have been cast from the English language because it's so misused. But the human, just say human, not qualifying it in any way, is a distinct entity, not related to apes or monkeys or gorillas or, you know, any more than related to a salmon or a snail. They both got two eyes. You know, they have backbones. The snail doesn't, but the fish does. And but the, you know, there the similarities end. These are all distinct, you know, and I'm not going to use the word species. We need a new word there. Entities. Okay, so anyway, back to the idea of academicians protecting their turf and being afraid that someone will ridicule them if they talk to someone outside of the realm. And like I say, this, I hope the person that pulled this one on me is listening tonight and understands that they, you know, they're guarding their realm, and they're really a small person. Because instead of doing the right thing and pursuing something, they opted to default to the going back to normalization and not dealing with an issue in their field, which then completely destroys pretty much everything they did. That's a good example of this. A different example is with the Dirty Snowball Comet model. The European Space Agency lands on a comet nucleus, you know, which is supposed to be a dirty snowball. There ain't no snow, there ain't no ice, there's no water, there's nothing coming off the nucleus of any kind, especially water, and there's no H2O of any kind in any form. Yet they keep calling it a dirty snowball. And at the Paris Air Show, this was so quite a few years ago, when the Rosetta mission was being, the results were being announced, where they actually landed the Philae lander actually landed on the comet nucleus, took a sample, and found many organic molecules, not a single molecule of water, H2O. And he hung his head and kind of mumbled under his breath that the Dirty Snowball Comet model was just, it was dead. It was no longer valid. And of course, we knew that. The Russian scientists knew that. When the Schumacher-Levy 9 comet, 21 pieces came into Jupiter, and they all of a sudden, at the same time as they crossed into the realm of Jupiter, became sulfur dioxide comets, because that was the local species. You know, the Russians knew. They said, that's the end of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. McCanny is right. And that was a case where, even to today, they still will talk about little icy wanderers and just absurdity. But that's going on in the math world today, where a great wall of denial has come over, especially in the work of prime numbers. very specifically, where the 150-year-old Riemann hypothesis has no predictive value in determining prime numbers. And my work on prime numbers should be forefront, because it eliminates the need for the Riemann hypothesis. But there again, these people are protecting their little realm. And the reason is because they're afraid that somebody's going to laugh at them, so they're going to ridicule them. And in their old age, they would be set aside as some kind of crazy old person. And that would happen overnight, and they would lose all their status. So instead of doing that, instead of making an announcement that, no, they have to stay with the status quo and keep their dignity. There's no dignity. Because history, this is the thing, and I hope this person is listening, that eventually history will find this out. And the damage to your lofty personal record will be much more tarnished at that point, knowing that you did the wrong thing and did not take this on and do the right thing and pursue it. You're doing the thing that's politically motivated, politically correct at the time. And history has a very dim view of those people once it's found out. And, you know, that will be found out. Okay, on to the next topic. But that's just a little ongoing discussion about academicians, how they hover over their lofty positions and guard it. But like I say, eventually time will discover this and put you in your proper place in history, which is not very good, not a very good place. This has happened many times in history where scientists, mathematicians, or whatever have been discovered to be basically doing that, guarding the realm and not letting forth new information because they wanted to protect their image. Okay. But back to, let's go back to the physics in the Bible. So one of the great examples, like I said, was when Christ predicting the end day prophecies. And he talks about seeing the signs in the heavens. So let's specifically look at some of these. The stars will seem to fall from the heaven. Now, he didn't say the stars will fall from the heavens. He said they seem to fall from the heavens. Well, what's that? That's a meteor stream. Where do meteor streams come from? From comets. There again, we get back to this idea that comets are not dirty snowballs. But and of course, most comets are small, but there have been big ones, really big ones, that have passed close to Earth. Those are the ones that do the damage. And so when he says every wall will fall, that's not a normal earthquake. That's not when the old terra firma is shaking to the point where every man-made structure will fall, not a stone left upon a stone. That's a clear indication that this is a passing comet with a great big nucleus that's doing a gravitational wave. Physics in the Bible. Things that at the time did not make any sense, didn't make any sense to the people. But today, in retrospect, looking back in terms of physics that we know today, that comets are not dirty snowballs, that they can be big, that they can come by Earth, and they have come by Earth, and they will come by Earth again in the future, not this week, not this month. And you can ignore all of the internet quackery about how in a year or two some asteroid's going to hit San Diego or some malarkey. That's all distraction. That's all distraction. It is put there to distract you. And that's even in the Bible. They say, well, one of the people in the audience on the Sermon on the Mount says, hey, you know, if all these learned people are coming out to lead us astray, how are we going to know it? And Christ simply says, the truth is written in your heart. You will know it when you hear it. And that's why the media today has such trouble convincing the public of their baloney, because people just go, hey, this is baloney. Remember that great scene in the movie V for Vendetta? And there's a bar scene. And it's like an Irish pub or a British pub. And these guys are sitting around drinking their ale. And there's a thing that comes on the telly. And they're all watching, and it's one of these government-sponsored news blips. And this guy blurts out, nobody believes this crap, or something to that effect. That's paraphrased. But basically, that's showing that the average guy on the street in England didn't believe the baloney that the government news agencies was putting out. And that's why the news agencies have such trouble convincing people of anything, is because people just have this BS meter built in, and they just don't believe everything they hear. And then once you realize that this is all baloney, then you just turn it off. That's why nobody listens to CNN anymore. And you wonder, with the ratings as low as these outfits are, how do they keep going? Well, they get money from the CIA. CIA is, I call it the Candy Nugget News. CNN is the CNN, is the CIA-supported news channel. And so they're just converting their drug money and other international fraud, RICO money, into news media to try and pound some story into the public. And a lot of people believe it. A lot of people are out there and actually believe this. Imagine how ridiculous this is. You have graduate students in astronomy, for example, that believe that comets are dirty snowballs. How absurd. After landing on a nucleus of a comet, not seeing any ice or snow or water, nothing in the form of ice or snow or water coming off of the snowball, and still calling it a dirty snowball. I mean, that's about as absurd as it gets. And the same thing in mathematics with prime numbers. People still talking about the Riemann hypothesis, something that happened 150 years ago that has no predictive value. And even if it was solved regarding the zeros, it would have no predictive value in prime numbers. And that's the main thing, is where are these prime numbers? What is their rhyme and reason in the world? And the Riemann hypothesis has nothing to do with it. And everybody knows it. You could read the book by Derbyshire, very distinctly, and this is written for both mathematicians and the general public, a great book. And at the very end, he says, if the Riemann hypothesis were solved regarding the zeros, it would not have any real effect on the prime numbers, because it has no predictive value. It's not going to tell you where the prime numbers are, which numbers are prime. It just has no value in that respect. So what good is it? People have been, that's the crutch that people have been leaning on for 150 years. And it's a very poor crutch. Anyway, enough of that. So both fields, math and physics, space science, astronomy. But remember, then again, this is tier two. In the world of tier one mathematics, this is the military mathematics. I'll tell you a little story. When my book Calculate Primes came out in 2007, it was on Coast to Coast AM, internationally heard radio show. I released that book with the host George Norrie, and immediately the Navy, the military, started pursuing patching up their security codes on encryption and firewalls, because it depended on the RSA codes. And those were readily broken with the work on prime numbers, my work that I released on Calculate Primes. And so that was going on in Tier 1 mathematics, whereas Tier 2 mathematics just pretended like it didn't exist. So interesting, and that's going on today, just like I call it the dirty snowball of mathematics, that people are just in denial. They just have no clue what's going on there. But in Tier 1 mathematics, military mathematics, they were actively patching up there because the RSA codes, the public key encryption algorithms for encryption, were used in military satellites. It was in hardware, it was in software. They had no idea where it all was. And that's why Michael Chertoff came up on the podium a week after I released that book to the public and said that all of our encryption is broken, we don't know how bad it is, and we don't know how to fix it. That was literally what he said. And that was because of the new ability to break the RSA codes from what I published. But in the Tier 2 world of mathematics, university academic mathematics, they turned a blind eye to it. Anyway, interestingly enough, that same week, the RSA company dropped all its prize money for breaking its RSA codes. And the supercomputing organization for determining prime numbers made it, they outlawed the use of my algorithm for finding large prime numbers. That they had to use a specific algorithm using computational mathematics, using the standard division approach for locating prime numbers. They couldn't use my method. It was not allowed because it was too easy to find prime numbers now than by directly calculating them. Anyway, some fun and just some fun history facts not well known in the general world. Okay, so back to physics in the Bible. I'm going to jump off topic here for just a minute because this announcement just came out this last week. And now they're finding in Central Europe, and this has been going on for some time, some of the civilizations were claimed to be as much as 10,000 years old. But now they've uncovered an advanced civilization in Central Europe around 1600 BC that went under overnight, which fits exactly in the time frame of Velikovsky, once again, showing that the world was a very highly populated place around the time of Moses. And Moses, of course, was in Egypt. But at the same time, Moses is leaving with the Israelites, is leaving from Egypt. And I'll talk about that in a minute, the physics involved in that particular Exodus. There was an advanced civilization occupying Central Europe. And they have no idea who these people were, where they came from, but they were occupying Central Europe. And I can tell you who they were. They were Israelites because that's where the Israelites ended up after the Noah's flood. And so anyway, and the Moses was leaving Egypt around 1500 BC. That's about the time frame. And that's the time frame that Venus came by. So the world was fairly heavily populated, but of course in the Middle East, where our history comes from, the Greeks and the Egyptians primarily, we don't have any record of what happened in the rest of the world. We do have post-mortem, actually. They have a record of the Mayans and the Peruvians, the Incas, the modern residents of ancient Peru, where we have ample records of the Venus event. I mean, this is one of the, Quetzalcoatl clearly indicating the comet Venus. And there again, see, this is like the physics in the Bible. you could say physics and ancient history, and look at something like the Popol Vuh, the remaining records that the Spanish didn't burn, of the remaining record of the Mayan extensive library that they burned, absolutely absurd, but is very clear about who Quetzalcoatl is. And of course, in their way of thinking, Quetzalcoatl had many personas. It was the corn god, the one that brought them corn. Quetzalcoatl was a deity, was also the comet Venus, and was the bringer of high winds and earthquakes and tsunamis. And so very clearly that was their way of putting a personification on the things that happened from the comet. But well, now we know from my work on understanding what comets really are, is that these are effects of comets. So back to the end day prophecies, once again, the stars will seem to fall from the heavens. That's a meteor stream. The meteors, in fact, we call them shooting stars. That's one of the slang terms for a meteorite. Comes into the atmosphere, burns up, and leaves this trail. So it looks like the stars are falling from the sky. The moon will turn to blood, and we know that that's a many effects. It could be volcanoes on the moon that are running and turning to red, literally like rivers of red. Or it could be an atmospheric effect, which we have seen blood red moons because of atmospheric effects. So anyway, that could mean a number of issues relative to why the moon would turn to blood, and then the firmament being shaken. And now, so these are three different aspects of a large comet coming by in what they call the end days, the days when the Earth is just shaken to its knees. So anyway, physics in the Bible. I just want to pop in here before I get towards the end. A lot of times I run out of time at the end of the show, and I forget to mention that we have very nice discounts on the prices of the water filters, JMCC water filters. That's my own water filter company. I've been in business for 23 years, and those products, when you buy those, that helps support this show, the webpage, all the expenses. And you don't just give a donation, it's you get a really, really world-class product at a price that's below anything you're going to find. In fact, there's nothing like these products on the market. So the webpage is jmccwaterfilters.com. So the main products we have that beautiful sinks, stainless steel sink filter, which you install in the kitchen sink, and that you can purchase, of course, extra filter elements, stainless steel, a world-class product. And then we have the replacement filter elements for what, you know, let's just face it, people call a Berkey-style water filter. That's kind of the buzz term, even though apparently they are not in business anymore. I don't know what's going on with that. But anyway, be that as it may, that's the term people recognize when they talk about a stainless steel gravity water filter. And I have the replacement filter elements for those, the best ones on the market, the least expensive, and very high quality, modern technology. And then the flagship product is the MR5 whole house water filter. And a unique product. There's really nothing like it on the market, with two-stage ultra fiber stage one filter for 0.1 micron filtration. And then the inner core removes the chemicals that are in solution in the water. A amazing product. And those, we have what we call the best deal. That's the MR5, comes with its original set of five filters, the UV sterilizer, and two bulbs that gives you throughout 2 years, because each bulb you change out every 12 months. UV bulbs, they're 36 inches long. It's the biggest one on the market for the most effective water treatment. So that's the UV sterilizer. So you get the MR5, the UV sterilizer, and an extra set of filters for the MR5. And for an amazingly low price of $19.80, normally $25.80, so it's like literally $600 off, and a great price. And then you have that installed in your house, and it's the equivalent of having a fresh mountain stream in your house. So you take all the stuff that the city puts in your water, it comes from well water, wherever you get your water from, cleans all of that out and gives you really amazingly clean water. Okay, so anyway, go to the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. Okay, so on to the physics of the Bible. Now, okay, let's go back in history to Moses. Moses is leaving Egypt. He's got the Israelites. And by the way, there's not just a few of these people, there's about 7 million by the count of the various people. And yes, who are the Israelites? The Israelites were Caucasians, and the ancestors, like you today, you would call them the Scandinavians. This is what happened with the Israelites when they left Egypt, and they were successful. They wandered for 40 years in the desert. And remember that number 40 in the Bible, whether it's 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain with Noah, whether it was 40 days in the desert with Jesus, or it was whatever, that for number 40 keeps coming up. 40 years wandering in the desert with the Israelites. What it really means is more than they could count. So we really don't, it's not a literal term. It was like their number a million. Like 40 was the number so big that you couldn't imagine it. And so it was just longer than you could remember. So anyway, what happened to them is they migrated east and north, ended up on the Caucasian, that's why they call the Caucasus Mountains of Russia Caucasian, the peoples there, the white people, and they moved into Europe. Earlier in the show, I talked about this archaeological discovery recently where they found very advanced civilizations in Central Europe. But after, and now the Moses event was around 1500 BC. We have a fairly good time frame for that. But anyway, afterwards they migrated north and westerly into now what's northern Spain, and then ended up in the British Isles, into Ireland, and also going as far north as Scandinavia, and north around the peninsula and into the Scandinavian countries. And so that's where the modern white races come from. So the Israelites were white, blonde hair, blue-eyed, and they were subjected to servitude in Egypt. And we know how that happened. That servitude happened financially. And they were not really slaves. They were craftsmen. They were workers. But they kept apart because the Egyptians were a separate group of people who also kept apart. There was some mixing going on, but not much. And so anyway, the Israelites were the ancestors to the northern Europeans, basically, in a nutshell. Okay, and so, and nothing related to the Khazarians. That's a whole nother myth that I'm not going to go into tonight. But the anyway, when Moses is leaving with about 7 million of the Israelites following, this must have been quite a parade. And of course, in a time of destitute situation, lack of food, lack of, and then with this comet coming by and the pestilence, all the vermin coming out of the ground because of the electric fields of the comet, which I've talked about before, you have this pillar of fire that reaches up into the sky. And it's like a tornado. It's described literally as a tornado, a whirlwind column that extends up into the sky day and night. And this is the electrical discharge of the passing comet Venus. And if you want to see a great rendition of this, go and look at the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. A great movie And Hollywood did a very good job of replicating what is talked about in the Bible, the column of fire. And why is it considered fire? Because the electricity, in fact, there's many photos. If you see photos of a tornado at night, you'll see a lot of electrical discharge going on inside the tornado, and that's the same way with this electrical discharge from the passing comet, that it is lighting up kind of like a neon light bulb, this whirlwind of column reaching up into the heavens. So what they're describing here is something we can explain today from physics, from the physics of understanding what comets are, physics of understanding what was going on at the time. But the ancients didn't know that, so they just describe in figurative speech these effects. The parting of the Red Sea, which is a excuse me, I'm losing my voice, which is a physical event, a gravitational wave. Excuse me, I'm kind of losing my voice here. But a gravitational wave that sloshed the water back and forth. And of course, this takes, a period of 10, 12 hours probably to go back and then slosh back. But we know where they crossed. There's like an isthmus that is currently underwater in the Red Sea, but it's very shallow. And it wouldn't take much to move the water away as the comet comes by. It's like a tidal effect. Literally a tidal effect, just like the tides caused by the moon, but this is a passing comet, and so the water sloshes away from this isthmus the Israelites cross, and then when the Pharaoh's armies come into the region, the water comes back and kills them all. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, that's the literally, and of course, the Israelites had time to get across. You can imagine crossing an isthmus with 7 million people running. I mean, this had to be quite a scene. And in the movie, which was made when I was a kid, I mean, it was in the 1950s, I believe, the Ten Commandments, it's still available. You can see it, online. I recommend it highly to see these physical events. And there's a great write-up on this by one of my collaborators. I wouldn't say, I don't know if you'd call it that, but Yvonne Whiteman, I believe you pronounce it, from England, who's done amazing work on the Colburn. And she has just a tremendously wonderful write-up on the Exodus event, talking about the validity of all of the things that happened in the Bible. And I remember about 25 years ago, National Geographic did a special on the chariots that they found in that location in the Red Sea. So they found the chariots that have been there since Pharaoh's army went under. So Pharaoh's army, can you imagine this scene bearing down on the Israelites who've already crossed to the other side of the Red Sea? And here's the Pharaoh's army barreling down with chariots coming after them. That's going to go arrest them and take them back. And this wave comes in and washes them all away. And it happened. This is real history. This is not some fairy tale made up by somebody. This is real history. And they found the chariots. They found the chariots buried there. I remember seeing the photographs of the chariot wheels sticking up out of the sand under the water. Unbelievable. I mean, these are real pages of history, and this is like 1500 BC. So, but anyway, what's interesting is now understanding these events in terms of physics that we know happen in reality, the large comets, and then being corroborated in other areas of the world like the Incas and the Mayans. Remember, the Aztecs were not in existence yet. You had the Olmecs and the Tula. We don't really know who they were, but the people who lived in Tula, very advanced organizations north of what is now Mexico City. And those were the peoples who lived there at the time of the Venus event. And the Aztecs, the modern Aztecs, the ones that were there when the Spanish arrived, were in they came later. They were the offspring of the Tula. We don't really, like I say, we don't know. The Tula warriors, those immense statues, pillars that are carved, and we don't really know who did those. We don't know what people, but they were apparently a group of another group of people who went under on the same time frame, 1500 BC, during the Venus event. And of course, academicians cannot talk about this because it doesn't fit into their rosy little picture of the Earth developing all on its own without any outside effects. Okay. Anyway, hope that gives you a little bit of a feel for understanding the Bible with modern understanding of physics. Okay. Just to remind you, we have about 2 minutes left here, that the go to the water filter page and take part in that tremendous discount. The regular price, what I encourage people, by the way, in terms of water filters, is if you have a gravity water filter in the kitchen, that's okay, but it's really not enough in today's really highly toxic world. The biggest dose of toxins you get is in the daily shower, because your skin is this big absorber, and you have these chemicals that are coming. The city puts chemicals in. There's chemicals that come from the well water or surface water that they use at your city, or if you have a well, equally, then the surface water. A lot of times cities have surface water reserves or whatever, and that's polluted because of wastewater that goes into there, agricultural runoff, all kinds of things. So you have this chemical soup that's coming in your water supply. And you get the biggest dosage of these in the daily shower. You're breathing in that vapor, and it's coming in through your skin and goes right into your system, and that's where it stays. You accumulate this over time. So the whole house water filter filters the hot and cold water, so you don't need any more filters in the house. And anyway, that's for your health. It's a very low investment for a health of your family. And once again, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com. Go there and check it out. So I'm out of time again this week. It's a very wonderful visiting with you, 23 years now and running this show. James McCanney, Science Hour at the Crossroads, and we'll see you next week.